Hello, and welcome to the Strength to Be Human podcast with your host, author and playwright Mark Anthony Rossi. This show explores all forms of creativity for those searching for meaning and a place in the world. To err is human, but so is to love. Now, without further ado, here's your host.
Hi, this is Mark Rossi here. I'm with Strength for Being Human. This is the interview segment, and I'm with an incredibly fascinating guest, J.C. Salazar from Houston, Texas. He is a poet and an author. He's the author of the poetry book, States of Unitedness, which is great. I like the play of words on that. And, of course, the novel of Dreams and Thorns. Both of them available on Amazon. I really like the Kirkus excerpt review of it. I'll read that because I thought it was fascinating and certainly helps frame the show in a number of different directions. And here we go on that. An often richly drawn portrait of immigration, acculturation, and family loyalty. That's from Kirkus Review. So a great source, and you always want to consider the source when you look to buy a book. Well, that's one of the highest ones up there. So I'm not surprised because I've seen his writing. I read his writing. I love his writing. So thank you very much for being with us, JC.
Oh, thank you, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you? How's everything going?
Very good.
Great, great. Here I am starting my morning in Houston and excited to be with you in this program and to talk about writing and just in general sharing with you and your audience some of the trajectory that I followed. I kind of have a title. I did a presentation the other day at a college, and I titled it My Journey from Immigrant Barrio Boy to Published Author. And so some of those themes come up, obviously, in my writing and in general, the challenges of the life that I've had in terms of being an immigrant child. You know, I was brought to this country. My parents came when I was 9. So I had to live the life of an immigrant child that learns the language and then just kind of follows a certain trajectory to where I ended up loving the language so much that I became an English teacher. And then loving what I was teaching so much that I wanted to be like some of those writers that I was teaching about. And so, but that was the scariest part. that was the scary part that held me back the longest. Because when you're teaching great stuff, you can't compare yourself to that, you know. And so finally, when I started writing seriously for publication about 4 years ago, I realized that I had been denying myself certain permissions. And so one of the themes that I have in terms of discussing how to become a writer is permission, giving yourself permission to be whatever it is that you want to be.
Wow, that's a great subject. We really haven't covered that before in the show, and I just love it. Just continue,
yeah.
Please.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, sometimes I feel like I didn't really live a full life until I started writing. And that happened 4 years ago. I've been writing pretty much all my life, but I hadn't realized that, you know, because I ended up digging up some old stuff that I had written that was actually directly related to the themes of my novel. And I incorporated it. So two or three of the chapters I wrote 20, 25 years ago. But then, and I thought they were short stories, but they ended up a chapter in the novel. But in terms of permission, you know, I started out being a math major in college. And even at that point, when I started college, I was thinking, you know, I'm an immigrant kid, you know. It's like I was very attracted to English and to the language aspects of study. And I kept thinking, but, you know, do I even have a right to? Because when do you become American enough? Or when do you have enough language? And then I had one of my sophomore professors in a short story class. She asked me after a paper I wrote, she said, what is your major? And I said, math. And she said, have you considered English? And all of a sudden, this light went on, you know. It was like she was giving me permission. This amazing English teacher that I loved was thought I was good enough to major in English, you know. And so it was like the validation or the permission that in my mind is permission, like, hey, I can, you know, I am good enough. And so that was the beginning of a long process of, but you know, you need permission to have ownership of everything that comprises language, culture, writing, and even publishing. Because there seem to be gatekeepers at all of those places that are like, in some cases, do you know who they are or what they are? In some cases, they're invisible, but somehow you know that they're gatekeepers. And so, if you don't have permissions, like those gatekeepers are asking you for a ticket to enter. And so, that's what happened. In that case, I got my ticket to enter, and. In some cases, it's about also writing is so scary because you can fail so easily, or you think you can. And so you have to give yourself permission to fail and to succeed. I realize, you come to learn. And then you know, I was a teacher. In fact, I still consider myself a teacher. So part of what I do is try to lift students up and show them their potential.
You're never going to stop being a teacher. That last interview with Linda Imbler, she's over there teaching me and the audience.
Yeah.
And she's retired as well, so I guess you just don't stop, and I'm all right with that.
It's just something you do. I try not to be a grammar police or something like that on social media, but in your mind, you're always correcting everything and everybody. I gave myself permission to lose the humility. My mother is a very humble and she's humility-filled kind of person. She had a very hard life, and I think I inherited too much of that. And so I had to give myself permission to shed it, you know, to get rid of it.
Yes, and I agree. I know it sounds negative, but the humble rider is not normally the successful one because you have to go a little bit above that just to put yourself out there in front of somebody. I tell people all the time, writing is pretty much confrontational. And if you don't like the confrontation, it's going to be hard for you to adapt to doing it because you got to confront yourself. You got to confront your dreams and your consciousness. You got to confront your family. And often you got to confront the world.
Exactly, you know, and I was trained to respect, you know, the great writers of the canon of the academy, you know, and therefore the respect kind of got out of hand in terms of it paralyzed me for a while in terms of writing, in terms of my own writing, because how do you compare, I mean, to those great people, you know? To Fitzgerald and Hawthorne and all those people. And so I just decided, you know, I'm not going to compare. You know, when I started, finally, you know, I was like, I'm just going to do it. And if I compare myself, I will never start. So I then, believe it or not, I believe in models and in looking around for ways to improve. And I adopted a model of the Jewish community. And so I saw that there were many, many Jewish writers. And in my mind, there seemed to be more, I haven't done the research to prove this, but in my mind, there seemed to be a disproportionately large number of Jewish writers. And I thought, you know, there must be this cultural thing about it's okay to write, you know, or to try everything, you know. So I just decided I'm just going to be a little bit Jewish and just do it, whether that's real or not, you know. But then as far as the tools, you know, you need tools. How are you going to write? So I used to, believe it or not, I spent, or maybe of course you believe it because you talk to writers and you probably heard this before, but I used to have a dictionary in every room. And so this was before the internet and of course before we had everything in our phones. But if I was in the restroom, there was a dictionary. If I was in the kitchen, there was a dictionary. I thought words were the most amazing, beautiful. Dictionaries were just amazing and beautiful. And words, I could never get enough of learning more words. And or if I was thinking of something and I thought of a word, but I wasn't sure what it meant, you'd look it up immediately. So I think one of the main tools for writers, of course, is words. So I spent a lot of times, a lot of years focusing on that, growing the vocabulary. I still, to this day, I mean, I'm sitting here looking at like 10 dictionaries that sit beside my computer. I hardly ever open them anymore because I have everything now on my phone and my computer, but I can't just throw them away. I'm looking at them and they're beautiful. And then of course, another tool is other writers. And so, you know, like read everything you can from any source. So I then, unfortunately, I neglected reading for a long time because I had read so much in college that I was just, I felt like, well, you know, college, I have my degree and I did everything I was supposed to. So now it's time to relax a little bit. But the more you relax, the farther you get from it. So, and then I started reading things related to my profession or career advancing type of literature or pamphlets and so on. And you end up, you know, just straying from the stuff you really love, the fiction, which is me. I like, my style is to write about real people. I think, I may talk about that in a bit, about what stuff that I believe as a writer. But then I picked up books again, and because I've been reading, you know, biographies and interesting stuff, but I read some self-help books. In fact, one self-help book was amazing. It almost saved my life. Erroneous Zones by Wayne Dyer. But today I follow Stephen King's advice and just read voraciously every spare moment of the day. So now, instead of dictionaries everywhere, I have books everywhere. And if I even take my book with me, and I have my Kindle on my phone, so I have my books. If I'm waiting at a doctor's office and, you know, I have some spare time, I might read something.
I agree. It's one of the things I say on a more consistent basis is reading is key to writing. So whenever somebody, especially a younger person, asks, I'm like, you gotta have a regular diet of reading as well, because you see how other people put things together. you kind of get thoughts from their thoughts, and it helps spur you on. So the creativity that you're taking in, it helps you also in many ways become creative. And by the way, thank you for reading my my writing book, Waking the Lion, and I really appreciate your commentary on it in the past last year. That was very gracious of you, and I'm hoping it was also another useful tool for you as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was your writing and just your style in general is inspirational. You have, I don't know, a knack for touching on truths, you know, and just kind of exposing certain things that, you know, that make you think, that make you say, yeah, that's right. I've been thinking that, and I hadn't put it into words like that. And somehow you give courage. I mean, I think if I had one word to summarize some of the stuff that you write is courage. You give writers courage to be bolder, to be more assertive, and even to dig inside and find more gold, so to speak. So, absolutely,
Thank you very much. That's an incredible compliment. I think you're going to find that writers come in certain like categories or classifications. So you got some writers that they like to write about the past in a historical way, or even just in a fascinating way. And then you have some writers like myself that I just pretty much want to write about the things that I think a lot of people are thinking about because I'm thinking about them, and that's what I do. Right. And then you got writers like Linda Imbler, and she's all about the what if, always making you think about the future, what could possibly happen. I'm not big on that, but she's really good on doing that. So a lot of us find certain angles that we feel comfortable with because they may be the central questions about how we operate as people.
Yeah, I love the what if aspect as well, but it's not what I write, you know. So I feel that right now, the most exciting thing about my writing right now is that I haven't done most of it. Is that so? I want to try, you know. I want to write something in the what if, and I want to write a lot more in different genres, and some of them may work better than others, or I don't know. I have this thoughts. I have a work in progress that incorporates a little bit of magical realism and a little bit of fantasy, only in that way, because I'm not big on fantasy either. You know, again, because part of what helps me, or what has helped me when I was not writing, was things that were in some ways tools for coping. And you know, nobody warns a child how rough society can be, you know, how rough life as a grown-up can be. And so then you start finding out, you start learning a lot of things that are disappointing, or you know, whatever, and so you realize I need tools. I need to be able to cope. And sometimes you get those from your parents because you have professional parents that do that. Well, my parents didn't have education. My father had a third grade education. My mother's second grade. They were farmer immigrants from Mexico, and they had very traditional views on things, but they taught us a lot of things, but they couldn't teach us certain things about a modern America, cosmopolitan place like Houston. And I've lived here since I was 9. So Houston is, I've grown with Houston, and I've seen it grow as well. So whatever it was in 1965, it certainly is not that today. So,
look at that.
But I also joined writers. As far as tools, you know, for a writer, I then took a few classes. I took a class with Cynthia McDonald at the University of Houston. She started the creative writing program, which eventually became the number one program, tied with Iowa as far as creative writing. And she was an amazing poet herself and opera singer and other things. And I took a workshop. I took two or three workshops, actually, on my own from writers who were majoring in the University of Houston program. And then, of course, and I took an online workshop with James Patterson. And all of them have been instrumental in some way because, you know, James Patterson is a very different approach to writing because he's all about making money. And the formula, he comes from a marketing background and whatever. So he learned the formula early on for producing two and three books a year instead of one a year like it used to be. And so it's all for him, it's all about that income. And so he writes commercial stories that people want to read quickly and so on. It is not even close to my style, but it's good to know that what's out there, you know, was how to differentiate. And I've read, of course, some writing books, aspects of the novel. It was by Forster. It was very interesting, even though he wrote it in the 20s. And with his somewhat archaic style, English style. But I still recommend that a lot for as far as writing. And of course, I read Stephen King on writing because it's interesting to see Stephen King on writing. He focuses on, you know, it's like a biography, but it's a biography of the things that affected him as a writer and that propelled his writing forward. So it's not everything about his life. It's the only the aspects that have to do with how writing, how his writing developed. And that makes it interesting, I think. And then, of course, he gives, you know, some of the practical advice later on as well. But yeah, I think that's part of the tools. A lot of people don't realize how much really goes into developing yourself as a writer, you know, and
yeah, some writers don't even know that. I talk to them all the time. They're like, what? I'm supposed to be organized and use time management? What are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not like, oh, I have a great idea. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to become a writer. Not exactly, you know, and maybe, of course, there's always exceptions. You know, I don't believe that just there's one rule and that's it. But anyway, so that's sort of like, okay, you have your tools. You have to make yourself somewhat prepared. Because a lot of it is responsibility. I think writers have great responsibility. You know, if I move to the area of what do I believe about writing, you know, and so I have to say, first of all, I haven't said it, but let me just say this: writing is love. The my main goal is to grow love in every reader of my work, because I believe that love is the answer to a lot of the problems, and even if it's not the answer, it's a good thing. So, I've argued with some colleagues about, for example, I criticize Heart of Darkness for being racist. And I think that writers have a responsibility not to be racist. You know, racism is hate, and I am all about love. So, it's other things as well. I mean, it's ignorance and
I think you're making an excellent point, and on that particular novel, I don't think lots of people are going to disagree with you. Even folks are a little shy about that subject.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I got a lot of flack some time ago about Salman Rushdie's The Satanic Voices. I'm like, listen, I don't care how great a writer you are. When you're telling us in public that you willfully wrote something against some religious prophet, trying to make him into some kind of horrible monster and say that their sacred Bible is pretty much from the devil, and you're wondering why 1 billion people are upset with you and people are killing each other and they want to kill you. And now I don't agree that that's the way to go about him, to object to what he's doing. But when he's willfully doing that, which you're literally saying, I'm willfully being blasphemous and bigoted, then why should not people be upset? And why should you not say, you know, you have some responsibilities. You just can't write anything you want and you think it's funny. And the next thing you know, you're living like a prisoner under the protection of England because the whole world wants to kill you.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a shame because, I mean, he had to, that was deliberate. That was deliberately provocative. And he got, I guess, the results that he expected, maybe even, of course, even beyond, because then there's a death threat now. But, you know, it's a shame because he writes so well. You know, his other book that, of course, I'm going to forget the name because I have this trouble, this habit of forgetting names.
Well, the one book he was really, really popular for, and that had nothing to do with that, was Midnight's Children.
Yeah, Midnight's Children. Yeah. I read that one, and it was amazing.
Which is part of my comparison of my criticism. I'm like, you go from Midnight Children to this? I mean, come on. There's no way you can tell us that this was an accident. You're being provocative, but you're doing it in a way that's unsafe, that's dangerous, that is bigoted, especially since he's crying about racism in England, being an Indian fellow, and then he's doing this. So it really is disappointing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and so, you know, I just, that's just part of what I believe in terms of the general, but I also believe that writing is life. You know, I discovered, every great piece must offer a nugget of truth about the real world and what living in the real world requires. And I think that, I mean, that happens even with fantasy, even with science fiction and so on. But for me, I still am sort of like the more realistic. If you look like my next door neighbor going through a situation, that's the more interesting story to me than a made up creature from outer space. Who is doing something amazing.
No, I understand what you're saying.
And writing is power, you know, because a writer has the power to control characters, and you're like this vehicle for exercising almost unlimited power in so many ways on the page.
You're like a god for a little while.
Yeah, yeah. So. And somehow that feels good.
Sure.
You know, I can control my characters' lives and I know them intimately, inside and out. And there's something about, you know, again, back to the permission thing, where it's like, give yourself permission to see every character in all of his or her complexities. And then you realize how, you know, amazing a power that is, because that also makes you look at yourself. I ended up, when I was writing Of Dreams and Thorns, you know, it is fiction, but it is based on real people. I mean, it is inspired by real people. And the cover picture is my father, for example, at age 28. And so he's a central character, and in exploring these characters in order to project them as fully as possible, I ended up in places where I was choked up. I was emotional, and because I was learning things that were painful, and and things that might have stayed private if I had not thought about it, if I had not thought of exploring all of the meaning behind certain actions and certain things that that were going on with these characters. And it was amazing. You know, it was just amazing.
Well, writing can be, even by accident, a type of therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the therapeutic aspect, absolutely. No doubt about that. Now, one area where some might disagree is I believe writing is political. Especially as a Hispanic writer, just by writing, I'm a political person. And so it's a very subtle thing because obviously I'm not writing openly political things. But there are still some places where American Hispanic writers are not respected enough. You know, we are not even close to the level of Hispanics having an equivalent to Toni Morrison, for example, as far as the Black community.
Yes.
And so as a minority community, I have to be aware of all of those things as well. And, you know, because I can't be talking about a writer has to be honest and has to be real and has to be about reality and the real world and then conveniently avoid uncomfortable truths, you know. And so a lot of the truths in the discussion of ethnicity are uncomfortable. So, but by the very fact that it's uncomfortable makes it in some way political. And I'm okay with that because I believe in my heart that all writers, all artists in general, should be addressing some of the political things, especially if there is injustice involved. Because I think we writers have a responsibility to make the world better. And so sometimes when I criticize Hollywood, it's because of the writers that they're like in a contest to see who can use more obscenities in their sitcom or this or that. And, you know, the hack writers, I suppose. But in general, I still am about the great writers that I taught in school and in college and that I learned. And those were, they were not exactly likable people all the time, but they were writing about stuff that made you think like philosophers in some ways. I mean, there's an element of philosophy. If writing doesn't include some element of philosophy, even if it's small, then it is weak writing.
You know? Well, that's actually my personal view on a lot of writing, even though I, as an editor of a journal, I'm not going to enforce that on everyone because that would be unfair. Mm-hmm. But it's what I would prefer to write and what I prefer to hear and what I prefer to see whenever I can. And we, meaning you and I, we don't disagree that writing can be political or in some cases should be, especially if it's trying to correct some kind of a social injustice. But what I always say to everyone, because I get lots of folks that bring me things or talk to me about things, I just remind them that no matter how passionate you are, if it's not in the framework of art, all you got is a bumper sticker, all you got is propaganda, you're going to have something that's going to be, it's going to be halfway where it needs to be at, and therefore you're not going to make that connection. You're going to be looked as just a ranter rather than a writer,
right.
You know, and then you pretty much fail on what you want to get done. And sometimes some of the younger writers, they don't get that connection that they have to be an artist before they're going to be a community organizer. They have to do that first, because if they don't, they're not really going to get across what they want to do. And if that's all they want to do, then maybe writing really isn't for them anyway. Maybe they should just go do that other thing. But if they want to combine the both, you got to be an artist first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. You know, and that is the challenge for the writer, and it is also the challenge for the activist who thinks that they're a writer. Because you're right, if it's just about activism, it's not writing. I'm already It's bad writing. And so, absolutely, I agree. Just as you should not be writing, I'm helping a friend edit some short stories. And the first one he presented, he felt the need to summarize the point that he was making. And I told him that's like you're trying to teach a lesson and you're repeating the obvious, you know. So don't be didactic. Just tell the story and let the reader learn that whatever they're going to learn, even if it's incomplete. And, you know, you fear that it's going to be misinterpreted and they won't really get the message you want them to get. But that's okay, you know, because enough people will. And so absolutely, I don't believe you should be writing to teach lessons, because you should be writing a beautiful story first and foremost. But there's no reason why the themes cannot address some of the wrongs in the world. And so that would make it political, I think.
Yeah, and I'm all for that. And just to talk slightly about the other thing you brought up, which is a really meaningful topic that we don't hear a lot about, is what has happened to the Hispanic writer that form of writing hasn't gotten up there, along with what the African American community has done, like the Toni Morrisons and, you know, and all that. And the only thing I can come up with is that there hasn't really been in literature and in American literature with a Hispanic American writer that real big crossover hit yet. I think when that happens, then people are going to look at it all with new eyes and then investigate further. Because if you look at it just superficially, without trying to be controversial over here, I don't believe that the connection between the average person out there in America and the Hispanic community is there, because there's still that whole bridge about, well, am I going to hear a different language? Am I going to hear something that's foreign to my American experience? Where the African American writer has now become so, in many ways, assimilated to the American culture that there's not such daylight that it is still with the Hispanic culture.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I agree. The fact that we have bilingualism as part of our identity makes it harder for some writers to develop both languages. Being bilingual is a great responsibility. If you're truly bilingual, you're going to have to elevate both languages to a certain level for creative purposes. So I myself do not write in Spanish because I don't have Spanish. English is my dominant language, and I don't have the Spanish, enough Spanish that I would need. Yes, I can sprinkle some here and there, but generally speaking, I know what great writers who write in Spanish, what they sound like, what they look like, you know, Carlos Fuentes and, you know, of course, Cervantes, or there's just a number of them, Pablo Neruda, whatever. There's no way that I can do that with my Spanish. It's simply not going to be there, because I am living in an English-speaking country that does not offer me any opportunity to develop my Spanish to that level. And it would take a personal commitment of really hard work to develop it on my own. And so I know that. And what America doesn't know is how well we do speak English, and how many of us are English dominant over anything else. And so I want to tell my story. In fact, Of Dreams and Thorns has very little Spanish in it. I wouldn't even say it has any. It has a few phrases. And I've seen more French in some books than I have seen Spanish in my own. So
I hear you.
So I have been criticized. In fact, somebody I respect a lot almost stopped speaking to me because I made a comment about we should teach young Hispanic aspiring writers to focus on writing only in English. And so I got in trouble. And I say that with a lot of pain in my heart because I love languages, all languages, and I love Spanish. But I also want I don't want any distractions in developing the English that is required for that great crossover novel, as you said. And so, you know, it may be a foolish fantasy, and it may happen on its own in some other way. That's just sort of where I am in terms of.
I actually completely understand what you're saying, and I really don't even think it's a foolish fantasy, but I think that on the outside world of the Hispanic writing culture, especially, it's not well known that there is a conflict there, and oftentimes there's fighting between folks, and I don't really think it helps them to cross over if they're fighting amongst themselves. I've heard people tell me already, you know, Mark, if you're going to have people on that who are not fluent in Spanish, then how are you going to call them Hispanic writers? Maybe you're just feeding into something that's false. And I'm like, listen, to me, that's just another form of bigotry.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make any sense to me. You know?
You're cutting off, Mark.
Oh.
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, now.
All right. No, but I was, I don't know if you heard my previous comment, but I'd had a few people that approached me about bringing on Hispanic writers, but they wanted to set the agenda that, you know, unless you were fluent in Spanish and you were also writing in Spanish and you were actually doing something in the world to promote that, therefore, if you were just English or English dominant, then you're not really a Hispanic person. You're not really representing correctly. So therefore, if I put anybody on there, that I'm committing some sort of fraud or helping some kind of fraud. And I said, listen, so as far as I'm concerned, that's just another form of bigotry. And that kind of fighting inside a community, it holds it back. It doesn't bring anything forward because somebody outside, they're already trying to learn what's going on. And then you're going to have some giant civil war about something like this. You make people even more confused. You push them away. And you're really tearing yourself down. And I think that that's a very bad thing. I'm not going to feed into that because I don't believe that at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Anytime you end up having and spending energy on whether you want to call yourself Chicano over Hispanic over Latino over Latinx or whatever, you're wasting energy. You know, there's energy that's energy because usually that energy is very emotional, and the more emotion there is, the more energy you're wasting. You could be using that energy for creative purposes instead of defending a label. And so, but that's another aspect of, you know, what I jokingly call my Jewish role models, which is like, don't worry about the label. Just do what you're supposed to do. You do what you have to do. So unfortunately, there is some of that going on. I try to adapt, you know, to every circumstance. If I'm around people who call themselves Chicanos, that's what I am. If I'm around people who call themselves Latinx, that's what I am. So my own instinct is Hispanic, and I have no problem with it. I do not consider it a made-up word by the Nixon administration.
I've heard that too already.
You know, it's a real word. It's in the dictionary. It has meaning. And it is also an umbrella. And for me, umbrellas are good because we all get under the umbrella, you know. And so that's an area that I think we agree on. You know, but, the other thing about writing is you can never retire. You know, so I feel like I'm retired now from what used to be my real job in terms of a college professor and administrator. But I'm writing, and I can't think, even if I don't get published, even if I don't finish, I can't think of not writing. You know,
the true sign of a writer is whenever they say something like that, then you know that that the commitment is not just in their brain any longer. It's now in their heart.
Yeah, somehow it's what you have to do. And so I I discovered that I was spending too much time writing thoughts on social media, and I should have been spending that time doing, you know, the kind of writing that I really want to do. Now, there's a part of me that does want to write a lot of political stuff, you know. Again, back to the philosophy, there is a lot of philosophy in politics, in good politics, you know. And so many things can get distorted. So a lot of great ideas can happen. But every great idea requires, you know, validation or proof or a full debate. And I guess there's a part of me that likes to have debate in terms of, you know, the one thing about being a teacher is that you feel, at least I did, and I think it's true for most teachers, you feel a great responsibility to give something to your students every day. You don't want students to come into your class, spend an hour in your class, and leave and have gotten nothing. And so, and the most important thing, you want to tell them truths. You don't want to be there making up stuff or lying. And so I hate liars. I can't stand it when some people lie deliberately and pretend that it's not a lie. Again, back to the idea of writers have a responsibility to be honest and to tell the truth and to be real. And so
no argument here. I mean, that's really what the show is all about. And I'm fortunate that people are listening because they can understand that straight talk in a world that can be very confusing and gray and polarizing is refreshing.
Yeah. And I would say one more thing I would say to you aspiring writers who are still not sure they want to open up their writing for publication is that, you know, deep down inside, every writer needs to be read, wants to be read. You don't just write and then if it's something worth writing, it's something worth reading. So you want somebody to read it. And so just tell yourself, you know, I'm going to put it out there and hope somebody reads it. If nobody does, well, nobody does, but at least you did your part. Of course, we also want to be validated, you know, validation is very important. And so we need to develop a very thick skin about rejections and, you know, because now the business, you know, I haven't talked about the business, mm-hmm. but I feel like I've earned a PhD in you know, in the business of publishing just in the past 4 years from all the stuff I've learned. But it is a tough business and also sacrifice, you know, because it takes a lot of sacrifice. In terms of, for example, passing up on parties, passing up on a lot of social interaction with real people. And that, in some ways, I remember reading a poem by Shelley once, I forget now the title, but it's about an artist sitting in a tower and looking out the window and watching the world go by. And writers have a responsibility to be, you know, in the world, but not of the world, so to speak. And so the world is there beside you. You're watching everything, but you can't really be part of it. You have to record it. You have to capture it in some way, but it goes on, you know, without you. And in some ways, that's a sacrifice.
I think it's the right word for it, because I know I've expressed something similar about that. When you have that commitment and you make those sacrifices, even just for a moment, writing becomes a noble pastime.
Yeah. And so basically I lost my train of thought, but I was trying to summarize the aspect of young people just growing ahead, or even not young people, because there's so much ageism out there.
Yeah.
I think I discovered ageism because most of the agents out there are young women, and here I am, an older Hispanic male, and it's very easy to be misinterpreted, or to even though, of course, these are professional people, they try to be objective and everything, but I definitely felt a sense of not fitting in. You know, for example, in magazines that publish work, they seem to prefer poems without punctuation. I'm a punctuation guy.
So. Yeah, me too.
So
I hear that.
And I haven't seen a good enough explanation as to why getting rid of punctuation is a good thing. I know sometimes it gives poems an extra dimension of, but that's not really a writer dimension. It's really more of a
reader thing. Yeah.
You know, if you don't punctuate something, it can go in all kinds of directions. We all know that if you put a comma in the wrong place, you can say something funny or gross or something. But anyway, I'm still so there are, I guess there are some generational things happening, or maybe. Because I also, again, when you major in English and literature, you end up with you studied a lot of old writers.
Yeah.
You know, so even though they're the greats from all around the world, they are also very old, and the modern world seems to want something hip and quick and I don't know, something that I haven't quite figured out.
It's why I believe, and I could be wrong, but it's why I believe that when that breakout book comes out from the Hispanic community, it's probably going to be a much, much younger writer that does it rather than somebody older. They're probably
right.
going to be set in the way just because a lot of other people in that age group will willing to cross over because they don't care. They just want to hear something interesting.
Right, right. Because the agents and the publishing companies want writers to be almost celebrities. You know, they want you to have a huge media, social media presence, and they want you to, if you're a celebrity, you get published easily.
Mm-hmm.
So even a minor celebrity gets consideration over a good writer who's not well known, who's a bit of a hermit or whatever. So what do you do with a celebrity? You want them to keep making you money. So you want younger people who are going to be energetic about enjoying celebrity. You know, I'm a little bit reclusive. I do not enjoy celebrity. I do what I can. I like to be as open-minded and flexible as possible. The non-writer me is a quiet homebody type of person. The writer me, you know, is a persona. It's a persona because I have to do many things, including this interview, for example, that I don't normally do or that I don't necessarily feel comfortable with. But I know that, you know, part of it is part of the job. Those are just kind of like asides on the business.
And I think it's real important what you had to say and how you came out to do something like this for the show and for the audience out there, especially some of the younger people that want to know from a perspective like you're coming from. If you're coming from an area that's not traditionally the place you think writers are going to come from, well, JC has a story to tell you that, yes, you can do that. You can go from the barrio to an English professor. I mean, I don't know if it's only in America that can happen, but I know we're definitely one of the places where it happens more.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you look at it from the studies and the statistics, I have broken all sorts of stereotypes and all sorts of statistics. An immigrant child from an impoverished background is not supposed to have done the things that I've done. Everybody will tell you, well, you know, you can't do that if your parents don't have a college education. But So in many ways, I've done that because I worked at it. I worked hard in my career. The thing is, just like I mentioned earlier about sacrifice in writing, there's always sacrifice. You know, no matter what anybody tells you about, you can have it all, you cannot have it all. You know, you have to make choices. And and so sometimes your time is your time. When you said it's a great, that great novel that explodes is going to come from a younger writer. Well, I think the main reason that it will come is that it takes time. You know, I am a better writer today than I was when I finished my first novel, because of that writing, because of that first novel, because of the things that I learned and how I've grown since then. And what does that take? That takes time. So young writers who are still not very good at writing, let's say, let's put it that way, and they should write anyway, because you're going to learn. Every time you finish a piece, it makes you better for the next one. And in time, if you do the right things, or if you do the right work, and if you know how to learn from your mistakes, in time you will write that great novel. But it does take that. It will take that time. And so that's the one thing I don't have. I mean, you know, I was diagnosed with cancer a few years ago. And so that was the reason that I chose self-publishing, because I didn't have 3 years to wait for my book to get through the cycle of whatever it goes through. Because it's a very time-consuming process to acquire an agent and then to sell it to a publisher and then a publisher to finally launch the book. It takes an average of 3 years. I did all of that research.
Yeah, it's about right.
And so, I mean, it can happen faster for some people. You know, if you're deemed a genius by somebody, or if your story is deemed irresistible,
you just catch a lucky break.
They'll put it on fast track. But that happens very little. So, and it doesn't happen with literary fiction, which is what I write. It happens mostly with
more commercial,
young adult commercial stuff. But but anyway, Mark, do you have any questions of any nature? I'd be happy to answer any.
Well, I'm extremely happy for you to be on this show and to talk about all that you talked about, because it's beyond brave, which we use so many times in society. But it also, it's again, and you've already said it, but I'll say it for you. You haven't retired from teaching, and you haven't retired from writing. In the end, you're still going out there and doing something that's going to, I believe, help change the world. You're going to have somebody out there. I think I mentioned this to you in text a few months back last year, but I put your poems out there on my site, my journal, the online literary journal, Ariel Chart.
Yes.
And
yes,
it wasn't even a week later, a young Hispanic poet said, "Oh my God, this is really about me, and this is incredible." And then he's like, "Well, what do you think about some of my work?" So I was able to check out some of his work, and he was excited. Mm-hmm. And just because of what you did, that brought him out of there, because he was like, "I don't really send somebody out. I'm not sure about this." He even expressed about, you know, are you okay with a Hispanic writer on your... I'm like, listen, I got people from all over the world. Why are you supposed to be any different? Just come over here and just show me what you got. Let's see what we got here. He did just fine, but he was pointing at you, and that wasn't a coincidence, and that wasn't an accident. You made something happen, JC, and that's what the power of the word is, and that's also the power of you just coming forward, which I can imagine is not such an easy thing sometimes.
Yeah, that's a great story. Thank you. I appreciate
it's
that.
It's a true story. That's what's so exciting about it. And this sort of thing happens, and people should know about that, how this kind of a show or what you're doing will have an impact to people that listen, so they know that not only are they not alone, but they should not be alone. And I tell people all the time, I said, listen, I'm not trying to be some tough love guy, but there's a lot out there. There's a lot for you to reach for, and there's a lot that's going to try to reach for you. If you still decide to be alone, Well, then that's just a personal choice because you can't tell me, hey, I don't see a Hispanic writer out there, so I don't know if I count. Well, I just showed you that you count. Now you not to believe you count and go out there and do the same thing because now that young fellow, he's going to help somebody else one day from what he did. And that's how it continues to go out there. That's what you have to do. And if you feel that you got to make the start yourself because you don't know anybody in your family that does this, or even anybody in your neighborhood, oh, well, then I guess you're going to have to be a leader on this. That's just the way it is.
Right. I absolutely agree. And that's part of what I do. That's part of what I want to do.
Well, I thank you very much for being on, JC. Folks, don't forget, he's got two good projects out there, okay? He got Of Dreams and Thorns, one of his novels that's been published. And, of course, he has a poetry collection. And that would be, let me see here. There we go. States of Unitedness. It's one of those things you have to really look at because it kind of takes you back a little bit because it's different than what you think. Like the United States, but this is States of Unitedness. And I see the play in words, but it's also a play in meaning, too. And it has a deeper meaning. And I got that because if you think about our country, and that means the country for you and I, JC, we say the United States. And then we go have a sandwich later and go, you know, it didn't feel so united today, you know. But if you could write a book that maybe helps bring us closer that way, then that's another a form and another function of writing that is noble. Right. And that is, I'm sorry to say, necessary more today than maybe even it was 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's about bonding and love and thing when it goes, sometimes it goes wrong, but how to make it right. And so sometimes it's just taking, getting to know each other a little bit. You know, I love that line from The King and I, you know, getting to know you, getting to know all about you, getting to like you, getting to hope you like me. And, that the teacher sings to the kids. And so it's, I just believe that when we know each other, we like each other.
Yes, and then what happens naturally is the barrier falls, and maybe sometimes the prejudice as well, because prejudice can't live once people start talking to each other. It dies quick.
Yeah, I agree.
It's like throwing bleach on bacteria. It'll be gone in a moment because it can't handle the strength of chlorine or the power of daylight or just a simple act of talking to somebody. You know, I'm living across the street from somebody for 10 years, and I don't want to talk to them because they're different. Well, that doesn't make any sense anymore these days. You're going to have to talk to somebody sooner or later. And then when you do, not only are you going to be surprised of how the difference wasn't so different, you're also going to be surprised at what the heck was I doing for 10 years? I could have had a friend in my corner. I could have had somebody that can share life with me. I can have somebody that we can joke around, and then maybe in a manly way, I can have somebody else to drink when the spouse is driving you crazy. So that's what prejudice keeps us from. It keeps us from all the normal and natural things that we should have. And when I think it was a black singer that said that prejudice was like a tool of the devil. It was a religious concept, but I agree with it wholeheartedly because if you think about it and if you believe in that sort of thing, it's a tool for things to be separate when they shouldn't be.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, folks, don't forget about Jay-Z Salazar. He's out there. He's writing. He's teaching. He cares. He, as you can tell, he can speak and speak eloquently. he's out of his house and out there doing some great things for us. So I thank you. You can find his books on Amazon. His bio and his link is also on the site here for Strength of the Be Human, so you can just click that and go check those out. And I think you'll not only be thrilled by what he's doing, but you're gonna be touched that in many cases, no matter who we are and what culture we come from or religion we practice or none at all, maybe you're gonna find that in the end, it's all about the journey that we're trying to make and the family that often helps ground us so that we don't lose ourselves in a complex world that can sometimes be dark, but it doesn't have to be if we stand up and say, I don't want this to be dark. I thank you all for coming on to the show and listening and supporting like you are. Thank you, JC. You were actually a listener.
Thank you so much, Mark.
And a supporter before
it.
You even came on. So thank you and God bless.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Please follow the show and visit our blog at strengthtobehuman.blogspot.com.